Hello, everybody. It's time for another OneLiner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and joining me are Scott Morris.
That would be me.
And Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
We have five films to look at today, so you would be best advised to pay attention.
Apparently, we have ways of making the audience not want to listen.
Yes.
The short point out that none of the films are Takashi Miike films. We put that project on ice.
Yeah. So without further ado, let's crack on. Okay, so this was going to be a Takashi Miike special this week, and we have broken our promise unto you that will be taking place at a later date when the three of us find time in our lives to fit it in amongst all the other stuff we've got going on.
Yeah, and when there's not so many tentpole films cluttering around, and when we're not about to subject ourselves to a lot of indie films over the coming weeks. So
yeah, it was probably a tad remiss of us to actually aim for it when we did, but there you go, the inexperience of youth, only we can't claim youth anymore. So what have we got on our plate tonight? First of all, I believe we will be discussing The Hangover Part 2. For those of you who saw The Hangover, it's unlikely that a plot recap will be required for The Hangover Part 2, in which the hilarious antics are transposed, I am informed, wholesale to Bangkok, Thailand. For those of you unfamiliar with the setup, Scott is going to explain.
Yes, well, I've no real idea why the original Hangover needs a sequel, but I suppose it made a lot of money, so here we are. This time around, Ed Helms' usually mild-mannered dentist, Stu, is getting married, and after a sensible period of refusing to have a stag night on the basis of the events of the previous film, he winds up going on a bender in Thailand with the crew of his previous adventure, the addition this time to be his bride's young brother, Teddy. The morning after, much the same things happened. Stu's woken up with a tribal tattoo around his eye, they've acquired a denim-clad monkey, and more worryingly, Ted's gone missing. Apart from his finger, which they've kindly left in the room. Cue panicked running around Bangkok trying to piece together what happened last night, in much the same fashion as happened in the last film, just pushed a little bit further. Now, I liked the first Hangover film well enough. It seemed to tread just the right line between bad taste and all-out farce to be amusing, without being kind of insulting or mean-spirited. It just worked quite well. Director Todd Phillips played much the same card in the recent Due Date, although it was starting to become a little bit too stupid for its own good there. Hangover Part 2 continues the trend. Thankfully, the rate of decline is fairly slow. It's difficult to really say very much about the film. Part of the comforting thing about these tentpole sequels is that it's not going to stray very far from a proven successful formula. Now, I like Ed Helms well enough in both this and his other work, so the heavier focus on his character is welcomed. The other characters in the ensemble are fine. Zach Galifianakis doing his increasingly typecast thing, which for me is on the verge of becoming tiresome, but not quite yet. And Bradley Cooper certainly exists. It's quite fashionable to bash the film, but it's just another film that really defies any useful review. If you're at all a fan of the first film, and many were, this is more of the same, and you'll get more or less the same enjoyment for more or less the same reason. It's overly reductive and harsh to talk about a film like this as just being a lazy sequel, as though there's some computer program where you just hit the sequel button and this just drops out. It's not as if no efforts have been spent on it, so calling it a lazy sequel is not fair, but I think it is fair to say that it's a sequel that deviates very little from type, and perhaps surprisingly, given the risque content, takes very few risks, which is all well and good, and again, it's perfectly entertaining for the duration it's on screen. For me, that's enough, and if you're expecting more from a sequel to a juvenile comedy film, then more fool you. It's exactly what you'd expect it to be. It's nothing more, it's nothing less. It's perfectly fine for a couple of hours dumb entertainment, but you're never going to think about it anymore after that. As I say, I always hate having to give reviews where it's like, if you like the first one, you'll like this, but that's basically all you can say about it. If you haven't seen the first one, you'd be better off seeing that one, because it is funnier, and it is better executed. But this really isn't bad.
You've certainly answered my question, Scott, because I was going to mention, you guys really quite enjoyed The Hangover, and I respect that, but I, when I finally got around to catching up with it, I wasn't all that blown away by it. I watched Due Date recently, and I actually enjoyed that more than I enjoyed The Hangover, I think. But I don't know what it was, it just didn't do it for me, and I was going to ask you if there's anything here that would convert me, but I guess that's a big fat no.
I assume not. As I say, I thought Due Date was pushing it towards a little bit being, you know, really silly, as opposed to Hangover, which was just silly, and this is more in the Due Date direction than it is the original Hangover direction, so maybe you would like this better than the first one, but it is basically the same.
Yeah,
I think it has to be pointed out, of course, too, that if you like Due Date more, Due Date does have Robert Downey Jr. and not Bradley Cooper.
This is a point. Whom my wife is after. Although now she's admitted that she quite likes Robert Downey Jr. as well, so I'm between a rock and a hard place there for my comic options, aren't I?
Well, at least if that was the case, so you know you were left for somebody who could act, right?
Yes.
I hope when you say she's after Bradley Cooper, it's in the sort of tracking down, hunting, going to kill sense.
Not the Irish way.
No.
I am afraid perhaps she is not, but you never know. Hangover.
Yes.
Arr, avast and that. Jack Sparrow is back to rob you of your £8 again. Does anybody really care what the plot of Pirates 4 is? I doubt it. For the record, Jack Sparrow is on the hunt for the Fountain of Youth. Only Blackbeard and his daughter are out to get there first. That, ostensibly from my online research, seems to be the plot which sustains, what, another 2.5 hours is it this time, or something like that?
Be careful about your use of the word sustain.
Yes. Excitement
possibly
is
also plot.
Well, they've always been a bit terse as concerns this franchise, aren't they? Excitement is exponentially less likely to ensue than it did in 3, which I assume was exponentially less likely to have delivered than 2, during which I fell asleep, and which certainly delivered exponentially less than the first, which was, by all accounts, halfway decent, if a little overlong. Drew, I've got a feeling that the law of diminishing returns is going to apply incredibly strictly to Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, or Pot Cost, as we like to call it around these parts.
Yes, you'd be right. I have in fact used that very phrase in my notes for it. It's another Pirates of the Caribbean film. Something I think the world would have continued quite happily without. But, you know, 2 out of the 3 previous films in the series have at least been reasonably enjoyable. And with our Orlando Bloom gone, and leading lady duties transferred from Keira Knightley to the far more capable Penelope Cruz, and Ian McShane playing a villain, you know, things might look, on paper, at least mildly promising. And as you said, they're in search of the Fountain of Youth because Jack Sparrow, while utterly hapless, apparently knows the location of every mysterious thing in existence. Which is convenient.
You had to get have her out.
There's really not a great deal more to say about this. It's a Pirates of the Caribbean film. Most of the stuff is nigh on carbon copy of stuff you've seen before, or the spirit is identical. And you've covered as much of the plot as you needed to in your introduction there, Craig. It's just a slightly different story with all the same stuff happening with the same people, bar there's slightly more charisma on screen because there's no Orlando Bloom. It doesn't bear speaking much about. I think the only thing to really highlight is that Ian McShane is a real disappointment. He plays Blackbeard, this mystical, magical pirate of pirates, the pirates that all others fear, as the film tells us. And he really should be this massive pantomime villain, you know, camping up, chewing the scenery and stealing every scene. But for some reason, he's playing it rather straight. At least that's the perception I got. He doesn't even manage to be menacing. He just turns out to be kind of dull. And that's just the feeling for the whole film. I mean, there's a few bits of amusement and some fun. A couple okay, no more than okay, chase sequences and a couple sword fights. But it's all very old hat by now. And it's just not really worth seeing. I mean, there can be no doubt now about Johnny Depp's Jack Sparrow massively being a victim of the law of diminishing returns. And too much of what happens just feels like a retread of what's happened before. And I'm repeating myself because the film does so much. I think fans of the series will get some enjoyment out of it. I mean, it's not an utterly awful film, and it's certainly better than Dead Man's Chest, but it's going to leave very little impact on your memory, and it's abundantly clear the series needs to be put to rest. It's dull.
It's dishwater dull. We wouldn't have seen that one coming.
I completely disagree. I thought that Pirates of the Caribbean 4 was much better than 2 and 3, and almost as good as the first one. Take that what you will. I don't really disagree with almost anything that Drew was saying there. I just enjoyed it more. The cast uniformly better than the last two. I thought McShane and Cruz are far better than Knightley and Bloom. It's a very welcome shot. 2 hours, 40 minutes, I think it might even be. But, you know, 10 minutes, that's credit, so perhaps doesn't count. It is definitely, in theory, far too long for this sort of thing. But it didn't really feel like it.
One thing, actually, I was rather surprised when Craig mentioned the runtime. That was, I mean, I didn't enjoy it an awful lot, but I didn't hate it, as I said, and I didn't actually notice the running time, so perhaps I enjoyed it more than I thought if it was that long I didn't notice.
But it does bomb along really nicely. And, okay, there's one sub-story which I think had to be put in to try and, a lame attempt to try and get some, you know, human interest in there, where it's got some soppy priest having a romance with a mermaid, which takes about half an hour, could easily have been excised from the film. But at the same time, it didn't really drag too much, because it didn't feel like it was having 2 hours, 40 minutes pass in that time. But, okay, in theory, yes, that's far too long, but in practice, it didn't really make much of a difference. Basically, the film is, again, come down to how sick you are of Johnny Depp's Keith Richard impersonation. If you've seen enough of that for your lifetime, then there's no reason to go and see Pirates of the Caribbean 4. As it stands, I could probably cope with another 2 hours of his impersonation every couple of years, and I would still find that relatively amusing just because I like the character. I think it's funny, and so I enjoyed the film because of that. It's all entirely predicated on Depp's charisma. The rest of it is competent. It's, you know, the action's well handled, the effects are pretty good, and so on and so forth. It's, the rest of it's somewhere between workmanlike and pretty good. Yeah, I enjoyed it more. I really have. It's almost exactly the same competence Drew have, but I enjoyed it in almost in spite of rather than because of that. But again, if you like Johnny Depp's Pirates act, I think this is a far better made film than the last two, and probably as good as the first.
Extreme stuff. The X-Men finally succumbed to the inevitable Year Zero Origins prequel. Straight off the back of his smoking reputation post-Kick-Ass, Matthew Vaughn hopes to bring his brand of ball-busting superhero shenanigans to a slightly more family-friendly franchise, explaining along the way just how Charles Xavier became so stressed as to lose his hair, how Eric Lenzer strove to outdo Uri Geller in the spoon-bending stakes. Scott, Law of Diminishing Returns, does it apply to prequels?
Surprisingly, no.
Ooh.
Right, well, bit of history. Say what you will about X-Men 3, The Last Stand, and you'd mainly say that it wasn't very good. It did at least leave the kind of mutant world in quite an interesting state where you could have done a lot of things with, you know, with mutants getting depowered and so on and so forth. So obviously, what we've decided to do is completely forget about that and go straight back. So you've had the Wolverine prequel, which is part of the franchise, so this, I guess, technically would be the fifth X-Men film, at which point you'd be expecting to bury the series. I think this is probably the best X-Men film that there's been, which surprised me enormously. So you go all the way back to a young pre-wheelchair Xavier. As a young kid, he befriends everyone's favourite blue shapeshifter, Mystique. They form a kind of brother-sister-like bond, and then it goes on to show us the young Eric Lynchier being persuaded into developing his powers at the hands of a ruthless Nazi, Joseph Mengele-style nuther, who will go on to be known as Sebastian Shaw, played by Kevin Bacon. It jumps forward a few years to the height of the US-Soviet Cold War tensions, and we rejoin Michael Fassbender's Proto-Magneto doing a spot of Nazi hunting, trying to track down Shaw. Meanwhile, Shaw's gathered a gang of dangerous mutants known as the Hellfire Club and is busy being rich, playing the Americans and Russians off against each other and being an all-round bad egg. Xavier is called on by the CIA as an expert in mutations after the agency suspects something unusual is going on with these Hellfire Club people, and he soon crosses paths with Shaw, coincidentally at the same time as Magneto does, saving him from certain death at the hands of the suddenly all-powerful mutant Shaw. The two form a believable bond that retroactively makes the respect for each other in the previous films make a hell of a lot more sense than it did going on the basis of the previous films. They team up, somewhat reluctantly, with the government in a bid to hurriedly find and train a team of young mutants to go against Shaw's squad, including a young Hank Beast McCoy, Cyclops' relative of some yet-to-be-determined nature, Alex Havoc Summers, and the ironically named Darwin, given the series' chronic misunderstanding of the concept of evolution. Right, I'll get the negatives out of the way first. The basic plot is familiar. It's not a million miles away from the X-Men 1 plot, and it feels a little bit hackneyed. A lot of the supporting cast of mutants are there only to sling a couple of powers around and have paper-thin characterization. And there's a few scenes, particularly early on with Eric's Nazi hunting, that would have been far more impactful without this thumping soundtrack accompanying it, although that probably would have put its 12A certification at risk, so I can kind of see why it's been done. Everything else I enjoyed wholeheartedly. James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender give tremendous performances, and they create a believable basis for the respect and the friendship that's been missing all along, and both have fun with the role. The scripting of both characters is spot on, and it's one of those rare films where you can not only understand exactly why the bad guy, in this case Magneto rather than Shaw, turns to form the philosophy that he then goes on to act on, and more than that, you can actually sympathise with it far more than Xavier's nominally correct course of action. Perhaps the biggest surprise is Kevin Bacon, as he is an absolute riot to watch. I had for some reason feared that he would just fall back into something like a reprise of his Hollow Man take on things, which would not have been pleasant to experience for anyone, but his Sebastian Shaw is a tremendous bad guy and as good a comic book villain as there's been. The action's well handled, and it doesn't feel like the layer of plot polyfiller that can often be the case in comic book films. And director Matthew Vaughn keeps everything bombing along nicely and keeps up his track record of having made no film that I haven't either enjoyed heartily or loved. Now, perhaps the same argument applies to the other films that we spoke of today. You know exactly what to expect before you hand over your money. The difference here, I suppose, is that X-Men First Class executes on its plan much more sure-footedly than others, and I think it ends up being the best of the X-Men films so far, or at the very least equal best with X-Men 2. There's really very little in here that I did not wholeheartedly enjoy. It's worth watching just for James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender alone. They give performances that are far better than you'd expect for a comic book franchise that's in its fifth incarnation. It's very, very well done handled, to have no complaints with it at all. I suppose it's playing a bit fast and loose with the chronology of the X-Men. If you're a comic book geek, you'll probably find a lot to pick flaws with, but well, I'm not. It's honestly as good as a comic book film as I've seen in the past 3-4 years. Highly recommend it.
Good lord. Ask any racing driver to name the most talented Formula One driver of all time, and there's an exceedingly good chance they'll say Ayrton Senna. For one so gifted and revered amongst both his public and his peers, it's perhaps surprising that it's taken so long for a high-profile documentary to come round the corner. Then again, perhaps it's taken this long to do the man justice, and that's certainly what Asif Kapadia has done with the critically revered festival favourite Senna. Drew, you're going to give us a few words on Senna, perhaps the best documentary I've seen in recent years.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, so this uses a mixture of archive footage, some of which was previously unseen, and home movies, with contributions from journalists, drivers, team members and family, to paint a portrait of the passion and exploits of the Brazilian motor racing legend Ayrton Senna. I think perhaps one of the reasons that it's taken so long to have the documentary, as you mentioned, Craig, is that no other filmmakers were given the access that Asif Kapadia was given, or given permission by their family to get a lot of the footage and to do interviews, etc. What these people did differently, I don't know, but they finally got access to quite an astonishing amount of material.
See, they obviously did some work on Bernie Eccleston.
Although, I mean, I think a lot of the footage, some of which is entirely unseen by anybody but the people who shot it, has come from, like I said, family movies. Some's come from people who had video cameras in the crowd at some instance. And it pretty much carries on chronologically from Ayrton Senna's first coming over to Europe and starting his Formula One career in the early 80s to his death at the San Marino Grand Prix at Imola in 1994. It's not like something that's got a plot, and it covers the stuff you would expect it to. His breaking into Formula One, his instant impact, some stunning drives in uncompetitive cars, most notably Monte Carlo, his move to a competitive team, his friendships and rivalries, particularly with the French driver Alain Prost. And there's not much to say about what happens, and here's some footage of Senna. What it does do, though, is paint a very good picture of an extremely talented, passionate and committed man, even if it isn't exactly warts and all. And I don't have an awful lot more to say about what goes on in it. But there was just something that really bothered me, and it's perhaps more of a technical issue, but there's a lot of interviews with people, but there's a lot of people heard in voiceover as you're seeing footage of racing, etc. But unfortunately, there are no captions to tell you who's speaking. And I wonder if like, they didn't do that because, I don't know, bothered putting captions on screen of the voice you're hearing would make it feel more like a television thing, perhaps. I can't think of any other good reason to do it, because it is a problem, particularly if they heard just in voiceover, but even interviews. When I can recognise the voices of those I'm familiar with, such as Prost or former McLaren team boss Ron Dennis, but many I have no idea of the identity of, and anyone less familiar with F1 will be a total loss. And it is significant, actually, because knowing the identity of the contributor is significant so you can judge the authority of their opinion. There are people commenting on changes in Senna's mood after a watershed career moment, or someone gives a description of the difficulty at cornering at the Imola turn where Senna had his fatal crash, and they would be worthy if they were given by, you know, a friend or an F1 driver respectively. But if the opinion comes from a journalist, then it can reasonably assume the statement has been plucked directly from their arse. And this isn't a piece of balanced journalism by any means, and those looking for an objective take on Senna's career should look elsewhere. Now, with Prost, his great rival, McLaren teammate, being the only significant negative contributor, this is rather a eulogy, which is not necessarily wrong, but it's not a piece of journalism, so I don't think people should have that perception of it. Mm. There's a number of other significant things, both positive and negative, missing. I think of him going to the rescue of a trapped driver in a car. Is left as a small window on the end of credits. and some of the rather less pleasant aspects of his personality are missed out altogether. But it's certainly an interesting look at one of Formula One's favourite sons, and anyone with an interest in motorsport will want to check it out. But it's far too flawed and unbalanced to have any lasting merit as a piece of sporting journalism. But certainly entertaining and interesting. Worth watching.
See, you hit the nail on the head when you said it's a eulogy. It's not. It doesn't set out to do anything other than put this man on a pedestal. And the reason I forgive it that is that few other sportsmen probably deserve to be put on one the way that Senna probably does. Like I say, it doesn't deal with the slightly more remiss aspects of his character, but then they weren't necessarily as relevant to the sport as his frankly, his fantasticness. There's a reason why he's called Saint Senna in Brazil. And it's the fact that he was the most fantastic Formula One driver, and he was fanatically passionate about the country from whence he came. He gave a hell of a lot of money to needy causes in Brazil. And I remember at the time that Senna had his fatal accident, I remember at the time thinking, oh man, you know, that's terrible. But perhaps I wasn't actually as aware of the man's character as I've become in the sort of intervening years, the more that I've read about him. And I think the power of the documentary for me was actually to watch it again and find myself infinitely more upset this time round than I was actually when it happened back in, was it 94? Did you say?
94, yeah.
Yeah. I think as a piece of sporting interest, it's as good a piece of filmmaking as I've seen. If you're only interested in how the man was as a racing driver, I think it's a pretty thrilling thing. I think it was quite a bold move to use entirely archive footage and have no editorial sort of narration to the piece whatsoever. Essentially, you're just watching things as they happen, the stream of clips in your life to make up your own mind. And I just thought it was really interesting and I really, really enjoyed it. Scott, did you see it?
Yes.
You did. What did you think?
Far too long.
It was, fair play, it was a tad on the long side.
Which cut did you see, though? Because,
well, this is what I was going to say, right? There's the theatrical one, which is about 90 minutes, which is far more sensible for someone like me who has no interest whatsoever in F1. And if I'd saw that, which I think basically is the same film, but with all the talking head bits with the, you know, the ESPN race commentator and, you know, the race boss, Les Dennis and Frankie Howard or whoever they are, they get cut out and the theatrical one, which I think would make it far better. The Blu-ray/DVD cut is insanely long.
Hours.
All of it's 2 hours 10 or literally something.
I think, isn't it pushing 3?
It's, as I said, it's nearly 3 hours.
Yeah,
I didn't feel like it.
So now we're 45 for the theatrical cut, which is what I watched, and it's nearly 3 hours for the extended cut.
That would have been a far better idea. This one is interspersed with it. I suspect it's probably got all the voices that you were complaining that weren't there, because I'm pretty sure the cut I saw actually had subtitles for who was speaking in voiceovers. Yeah. All I can say is, right, I did have to watch this in two shifts, but it was interesting enough for me to come back and watch the second half of it, even though, as I say, I have little to no interest in F1. I suppose the time that I was actually sort of slightly interested in this stuff would have been around about the time that Senna was knocking around, so it did kind of dovetail slightly with that window.
And when we were playing Ayrton Senna's Monaco GP yes, on our Mega Drives.
So in that respect, I found it interesting enough to watch, as Drew says, definitely not a documentary in the sort of the fully uncovered, you know, going to every aspect of it. Yeah, yeah, it's almost not a documentary. The way it paints Prost is almost a pantomime villain at points, yeah, which I think gets it.
He's French, he was a pantomime villain.
I mean, the only thing Prost really missing is a little moustache and Muttley.
Yes. What also annoyed me is the way it talks about how Senna's, you know, was revered in Brazil, which is fine, but I mean, this is the same time that Nelson Piquet was knocking about, and he has won 2-3 championships at the same kind of time, and he was mentioned once in passing. I thought that would have been interesting to at least look at. Why is, if Senna is so revered and Piquet isn't, then what's the deal with that?
Yeah, spot the difference.
Yeah, not even mentioned as far as I can remember. As I say, it's really hard for me to give a definitive opinion because I have no interest in subject matter. It was certainly interesting enough for me to watch all 3 hours or something of it, which has to be a vote of confidence in some the kind of mechanics of the film, especially if I have no interest in anything that was going on in the actual career of the man himself. So yeah, it is definitely worth watching. If you're the kind of person that's going to want to watch a film about Senna, you're probably as well watching the full cut, because I think if you don't really care much about Senna, whether it's 90 minutes or 3 hours, probably won't make a hell of a lot of difference to you. But certainly if you do have a fondness for the man, it's certainly well worth watching.
That's why I went for the long cut. It's as good a piece of work on the career of a sporting genius as I've ever seen, but that comes with the proviso, as Drew's quite rightly pointed out, that it's not to be taken in any kind of historical context as a rational document detailing all aspects of the man. Repeat, not all aspects of the man. But as a celebration of a sporting character, I just think it was fantastic. And I found myself going like, oh, he's dead. Aww. All over again.
Yeah, the one thing I would have liked more of, if we're just talking about this in a celebration, which I'm quite capable of enjoying it as simply that, saying this is a man who's talented, and perhaps it's different in the cut you saw, as I say, I saw the 1 hour 45 minute cut, but I just would have liked a bit more actual racing footage and a bit less of him on a speedboat. That sort of thing, you know. I kind of get the idea of showing that he's laid back and we got him with his, he was like spent time with his family and stuff, and he wasn't like completely focused on racing and nothing but I really would like to see a bit more of his talent in the car.
Do you need to see more of his talent? All I'm going to say there is broken gearbox.
Yes, that's
yeah. After which I needed a rest. You lay on your boat, Senna. You go on your speedboat, son. That's all right with me.
I was quite disappointed, though. You didn't cover at all the theory custard that pie I read fight. About. Sorry?
The custard pie fight. They didn't cover that at all.
They didn't. Nor did they cover the Senna death conspiracy theory, which I've never heard before, but found on comment on IdiotTube.
It's not that Kennedy's magic bullet came down out of orbit finally, did
it? It is that he was shot. There's a clip on... Oh, it was one of many clips on YouTube of Senna's accident.
Back and to the left.
Which I was checking it before, so I was filming to see like if I remembered it as clearly as I thought I did, and I did. But I was glancing at the comments underneath, and some idiot has written about this big screed about how Senna was actually shot, that it was impossible for a suspension arm to have hit his helmet. And if you look at his helmet, the whole match is exactly a bullet, and that he was killed. Shockingly, they didn't cover it at all in the film.
Oh,
and I really think I should mark it down a star for that alone.
To be honest, I'm all for going for one star now. Can Sam Worthington act? It seems like an easy question, but evidence either way is hard to find. Perhaps toward an end of settling the debate once and for all, he appears most recently in Last Night, debut directorial effort of the Jacket scriptwriter Massey Tadnov. Massey, if I'm doing you a disservice here, girl, let me know. Massey Tajidin. Also starring the Jacket's Keira Knightley. Last Night is a tale of a professional couple, Worthington and Knightley, each fighting naughty temptation in the other's absence, in the form of someone else whose name I'm going to do a huge disservice by saying Guillaume Canet. That sounds all right, doesn't it? And Eva Mendes. Mendes. It all sounds a little bit worthy and stage-like, but then I said the same thing about Closer and enjoyed that immensely. Scott.
A melodrama starring Keira Knightley and Sam Worthington, two of the least charismatic and engaging actors working today.
With my reputation.
Yeah, that works out as well as you'd expect.
So Craig's question's an example of Betteridge's Law, is it?
Yes. There really is nothing more to the plot than what you said there. A married couple whose relationship's gone off the boil spend the night apart. Worthington's character heads off to another city for a meeting along with his workmate Eva Mendes, who is, for some completely baffling reason, attracted to Worthington's bland, lifeless character. And meanwhile, Knightley runs into an old flame / love of her life, and both attempt to resist temptation with varying degrees of success. The credits roll, the film ends, no one is any of the wiser as to why we've been told this inordinately boring story with its unlikable characters, wooden performances, and chemistry-free relationships. The acting is...
Well, no strong feelings about it then, Scott.
Well, to the point, the acting's not bad, exactly. It's just perfunctory. Because of that, there's not a single one of the characters or any of the relationships that seem believable or worth investing any emotion in. So you don't. The film doesn't seem to say anything about the characters or their predicament either, and it's a sorry state of affairs when more is said about the human condition in a film about comic book mutants than in a relationship drama. I suspect it hoped to be relying more on low-key and subtle facial tells and ocular acting and all that kind of thing.
Knightley with facial subtle tells.
But sadly, the cast that's eventually become attached to it is... Well, okay, it's A-list, I guess, but none of them are particularly brilliant at that kind of subtlety or nuance, and as such, this feels a bit kind of am-dram. It's not that the cast aren't doing what they're scripted to do, it's that they just don't do anything more than that, which makes it something of a waste of time. It's perfunctory more than it is bad, to be fair, but it is somewhat below par. The only reason anyone's going to see this film at all is going to be as counter-programming to the big budget tentpoles that are knocking around, and to be honest, you would be much better served staying at home with with a bottle of wine and whatever DVD of a dozen or so similarly themed but better handled films that are knocking around. Hell, why not Closer? Go and see, go and watch that instead. It's much, much better. There's really nothing to recommend in here at all. It's well shot. It's competently put together. It's competently acted, but it's just really nothing more than competent and workmanlike, and there's nothing particularly special here. And it's not as though this kind of relationship drama segment of the market is not well served already by films since the beginning of films, and there's just no reason to see this unless for some reason you really like Sam Worthington, and if so, you have gone off the deep end of sanity and there is no hope for you. Bangkok has you now. I can't recommend it. It's the sort of mediocrity that I hate more than actual proper bad films, and that's kind of what riles me more about the film than anything else. It's just the sort of film that's very easy to, you know, watch and immediately forget about, as I shall now do.
Excellent. See, when you say about Keira Knightley, well, you don't say about Keira Knightley, you're talking about subtle facial expressions. It must be quite hard for her to do that, because I would imagine that her massive facial cross-section sort of flutters in the breeze quite a bit. The amount of air resistance it must meet. So it must be quite difficult for her to deliver any kind of subtle nuance.
Are you saying that she got a big face?
She got a big face. Just waiting on her chin coming back from Mars with a fucking soil sample at some point. Solar sail face. Yeah, that's perhaps a bit harsh. Well, there you go. What a rowdy bunch of stuff that was. Don't forget that if you have any comments or do you want to get your 2 pence worth in, whatever it may be, you can always drop us a line at podcast@theoneliner.com.
That would really be the main one.
Ooh.
Do you want my phone number?
Go on then.
It's, no, I'm not telling you that.
Why?
Okay, it's 078, no.
Each week we should give away a digit from our mobile phone numbers each, but not say what order they're in. See how long it takes for someone to track us down, kill us, skin us, and wear us as a hat.
I don't see the benefit in this for us.
It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting for the remaining two to watch whoever gets taken out first. Do you like scary movies?
Nah.
Anyway, in the meantime, you've been marvellous, and we were even better. I was Craig, Scott was Scott.
Hello, goodbye.
And Drew was, as always, the inimitable Mr. Drew.
Goodbye.
Maybe we'll be back soon enough with more banter for you, if you can put up with it. Take care. Bye. Ooh, you all know he got sniped. Boom, headshot. Crouch, crouch, crouch.